I'm Fathery.
This is Dave.
I'm Trent.
And this is Text Trek.
Engage.
Have another installment of Star Trek Number Ones, a series of videos where we will discuss the first episodes of the various Star Trek TV shows in anticipation of the premiere of Star Trek Discovery later this year, hopefully.
Once we knock this one out, we've only got two left, right?
Yep. After this, we'll be doing Voyager and Enterprise. Tonight is all about Deep Space Nine, and more specifically about the premiere episode, Emissary.
Emissary.
Not to be confused with The Emissary, a Season 2 Next Generation episode.
That'd be ridiculous.
We're just going to jump straight in with a quick summary. The episode opens at the Battle of Wolf 359 when Captain Picard is Locutus of Borg from the Next Generation episodes The Best of Both Worlds, Parts 1 and 2. And his Borg cube is laying waste to a Federation fleet. We have a young first officer, Commander Benjamin Sisko, aboard the Saratoga.
I'm always happy to see the Miranda-class ship in there, even though it'd be like way out of date, I guess.
And this is the Miranda-class ship from the beginning of Star Trek IV, The Voyage Home, the Saratoga.
Oh, okay.
And it's getting its ass kicked. It's getting held down with a tractor beam and getting shot with Borg phasers, and this ship's blowing up. We have a Vulcan captain who blows up, and half the crew blows up. The warp core is going to blow.
Lots of stuff getting blown up.
Then Sisko is running, trying to find his wife, Jennifer, his son, Jake. He finds the crushed body of his wife, Jennifer. He's futilely struggling to rescue her, and the tactical officer, this Bolian guy, is like, no, like, she's gone, we gotta go. And they run to the shuttlecraft and take off, and out the window he sees the Saratoga and basically his world where he worked, where he raised his family, be destroyed by Patrick Stewart as an evil cyborg.
I have Patrick to say, this is just real quick right off the bat, stronger grabber opening than Next Generation.
Yeah, hell yeah.
Who hasn't had their world blown up by Patrick Stewart,
I mean,
you know?
The Borg is as cool as it got as bad guys for Next Gen, and so when you open with that, it's pretty potent.
Yeah,
and it's not unlike, by the way, the first J.J. Abrams movie, the Star Trek 2009. Yeah. Big battle, big sacrifice, all that
and
stuff.
And you get emotionally engaged with the character right off the bat.
Yeah.
Well, then we cut to 3 years later.
He probably shouldn't have taken his kid to the Battle of Wolf 359. I bet his kid was like, I really want to go, Dad. And he's like, okay.
Well, the kid survived. It was the wife who should have stayed at home.
That's,
Just saying.
All right, proceed forward, sir.
Yeah, continue.
Three years later, his son Jake is fishing on a holodeck. And they're arriving at the new Starfleet Station, Deep Space Nine. It's a Cardassian station in orbit of the planet Bajor. The Bajorans being introduced in the previous couple of years on the Next Generation. Their occupation by the biggest assholes in the Alpha Quadrant, the Cardassians, is ending, and the Federation is taking over the station near Bajor to help prepare the Bajorans to enter the Federation.
And you know that, like, the Bajor is, like, they're, like, potentially going to collapse into civil war from, like, rival factions and stuff with this power vacuum and all that going on.
Yeah, it's basically been a planet that's been occupied by these fascist alien overlords, and rebel groups have driven them away, but now they have no way of trying to organize and create a stable working government between these different factions. So not unlike what happens in, you know, 20th century geopolitical affairs. Yeah. We have Chief O'Brien from the Enterprise is there. This old priest approaches Sisko and tells him something, the prophets await you, but he's like, I ain't got time for that shit now.
Who does?
That's verbatim.
O'Brien is telling him Picard wants to talk to you. He's like, no, I gotta go check out my office. And he gets in there and he finds Major Kira. We're introduced to her, one of the Bajoran terrorists who now is working in a official military structure. And she has bad hair.
You say Bajoran terrorist. Yeah. I say Bajoran freedom fighter.
Well, exactly.
Interchangeable. But she has some really, bad hair in this episode.
I think Star Trek has a long tradition of bad hair.
And bad civilian clothes.
Yeah.
But what's also bad is her attitude. Because she does not want the Federation here. She doesn't trust having another power outside of Bajor come in and get involved. And she's uncertain herself if their provisional government will hold together and if they'll ever be able to get their shit together on Bajor. Sisko says he wanted her. He wanted someone who was Bajoran. He thought it made sense and that he was hoping that they could find a way to work together. Meanwhile, there's looting on the promenade of the station. Odo, the security chief, is using his shape-shifting to catch a couple of thieves, one of whom is a Ferengi boy named Nog, who turns out to be the nephew of Quark, a local bartender and guy who ran the gambling Quark establishment. So they're getting his nephew arrested. Sisko sees that everyone on the promenade of this community, the city that used to live here, it's just falling apart and everyone just wants to get the hell out of there. He finally goes and talks to Picard. That was super awkward.
The guy who was responsible for all of this horror that happens, the guy who he blames for killing his wife.
We talked about how in Encounter at Farpoint for Next Generation, they don't actually eke a ton of drama out of the fact that Picard was the one who was like with Beverly Crusher's husband when he died. It's just, it's not as dramatic as they had hoped. Having your wife killed by one of Starfleet's highest ranking officers,
it's a little dramatic.
That's much higher on the drama scale.
Yeah,
by this guy who's just like revered and praised and loved throughout the Federation And
he's like, Sisko, I remember when you had an eye patch, man.
You know, Sisko lets them know, like, he's not happy with him. He's not happy about this assignment. You know, Picard says the Cardassians basically just, like, raped this planet, mined all the resources. It's worthless, and we need to help the Bajorans. They need to become part of the Federation, and we need to bring them into our fold. Sisko says he doesn't care about it, and he hopes to be reassigned, or he's going to quit. But in the meantime, he'll do his job. Sisko, trying to get the station back together, goes, talks to Quark, lets him know, I'm basically going to hold your nephew who got arrested. I'm going to hold him hostage unless you stay here, keep your business here, and become this community leader.
This has got to be like, this is a pretty big break from Star Trek philosophy when you have your effectively your captain character blackmailing. Let's be honest. He's blackmailing a guy to stay and work on the base and help it get in order.
Yeah,
it already shows he's willing to kind of bend some rules.
Yeah, we're a long way from the idealistic picture of Star Trek, you know.
And even Picard did sort of say, "Well, like anything short of the breaking the prime directive, to get things up and running and keep things smooth here."
And we see Sisko and Major Kira get to know each other a little bit more. She's trying to clean up the promenade and says, I guess Starfleet guys don't want to get their hands dirty. So he's helping her pick up.
Literally, physically, like, hauling trash and stuff with her.
You know, the weird old Bajoran priest shows up again and says, it's time. And he takes Sisko to meet Kai Opaka, who's basically like the Pope of Bajor. They're all very spiritual and religious, and this lady, Kai Opaka, tells them, you're the emissary, and you need to look at this orb, and she has this weird ancient-looking artifact. She calls it a Tear of the Prophets, and it's in this weird case, and when Sisko opens it and looks in, he's sent back in time to when he was a young man on the beach meeting Jennifer, the woman who would become his wife, and then he flashes back to where he was in the present.
We've all been there.
Yeah, those weird chemical flashbacks. Opaka lets him know that he's destined to find the home of the prophets, the celestial temple, and that he must find it before the Cardassians. And so He's kind of intrigued about this. You know, he's seen there's something weird with these orbs, with this religion. I'll look into it.
By the way, that broad arc and, you know, I guess everything that'll come of it, even though I have not seen all of DS9, I gather will become the overarching thing really throughout the series, right? Mm-hmm.
Yes, yeah.
So right from the first episode, they're like, hey, we got a big story to tell.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, and we see that carried out over 7 years. Sisko returns to the station, and suddenly the promenade has become a booming community. There's people drinking and gambling and buying things and selling things. And finally, the two other main cast members show up. We have Dax and Bashir. Dax is a Trill science officer. She has her body is host to a weird worm creature that's passed on from one person to the next and also carries that person's memories and personality. We have Dr. Bashir, this young, up-and-coming doctor who's... Looking for some adventure. He's looking glory. For a piece of
among,
ass also.
Among other things, yeah. He's looking for adventure. Yes.
And we should say, Dax was, in her previous incarnation, was a buddy with Sisko.
Yeah,
so right. They're mm-hmm. old friends.
And we see Chief O'Brien tour the Enterprise Bridge one last time, and then Captain Picard actually beams him to Deep Space Nine.
I think as he's about to go, he's like, now you see what it's like.
And then the...
ain't easy.
The Enterprise leaves, O'Brien and Dax are looking into the orb and finding this weird temple in the sky where mm-hmm. these prophets live. Meanwhile, as soon as the Enterprise leaves, some Cardassians roll up in one of their warships.
That's what they do.
Cool-looking ships.
Yeah, the Galer-class Cardassian ships. We meet Ghul Dukat, who is the greatest villain of Star Trek, hands down. Greater than Khan, Noonien, Singh. No competition. And he's former...
I'm not even going to bother to argue. It's so ridiculous of you to say that. But it is also... These are pretty different things. This is a long-running villain and a guy who had an episode and a movie. Different vibe.
Yeah.
But you go ahead and be dramatic and extol Ghul Dukat.
He's the former prefect of Bajor. And the station used to be under his command. His office now belongs to Ben Sisko. He has found out that Starfleet now has a presence here, and that they've also found one of these orbs that the Cardassians had been stealing from the Bajorans and studying. Sisko plays dumb, says he doesn't know what he's talking about, but Ghul Dukat says, okay, well, I hope you don't mind if I hang around.
Yeah, I did feel like one of the things I definitely noticed in this is the Cardassians seem to have really good intel. Bluffs and stuff they tried to pull on them, they're like, uh-huh. Sure.
Yeah, and we always see these conversations like this in Deep Space Nine with the veiled threats.
Everybody knows everything, yeah. And it's just mm-hmm. like, what are you willing to put on the line? What do mm-hmm. you know?
Yeah, and it kind of has like a Cold War type high tension, mm-hmm. you know, espionage going on in the background that we don't see, but we know that it's there type of vibe to it. Mm-hmm. So the Cardassians are hanging around. Dax thinks that she has located what they're looking for. It's a weird part of space where there's been several strange occurrences. It's in the Bajoran system near the station in the Denorius belt. Sisko and Dax get in one of the runabouts, the kind of oversized shuttlecraft, and go to investigate. Before they can do that, though, Odo has to sneak onto the Cardassian ship, disable their sensors so that the Cardassians don't see what they're doing, and the runabout, called the Rio Grande, very cool name, because for those of you in other countries who may not know, the Rio Grande River runs between Texas and Mexico. So not too far from where we live.
That's right.
And,
you know, they tend sometimes in Star Trek to go with what you might think of as slightly generic names. Not to point fingers at the new show, but Discovery, slightly bland name well, for a ship.
The runabouts are all named after rivers.
Oh, is that right?
Well, yeah. I didn't know that.
Yeah.
I did not know that either.
So the Rio Grande discovers the Bajoran wormhole, this big blue opening in space, and they fly into it. They go through a weird cosmic tunnel and end up 70,000 light years away in the Gamma Quadrant. And they turn around and come back through it, and then something strange happens while they're in this tunnel, and they land on a planet that's either stormy or nice weather, depending on which one of them you ask. And the The prophets make contact with Sisko, and we meet the wormhole aliens. They're worshipped by the Bajorans as these gods, these prophets, but they appear in the form of other characters that Sisko knows, that he's met recently, that he's remembering now that he's thinking about, you know, his wife back then in that time when Picard killed her.
Right, this is a pretty ambitious way to film it, where he's having extended conversations where, like, every other line is him talking to somebody else from his past at another location or some other distant time in the past. It was pretty interesting to see.
You're basically using all the other actors that you got for that episode mm-hmm. to play, like, the prophets. And he's trying to explain to these non-linear aliens how linear time works. He's trying to explain, past experiences and surprises. And
they don't get death.
Yeah, they don't comprehend any kind of change or passage of time. While that's going on, O'Brien is struggling to get the station moved because Kira came up with this idea to, there's a wormhole over here. We can move the station to the wormhole and the Cardassians won't be able to claim it. And it'll be a good thing for Bajor, and she can finally, for the first time, see a future for Bajor. You know, her whole life has been a hopeless struggle until now. This is the first glimmer of hope. So O'Brien finds a way to get the entire station to move, and while that's going on, the Cardassians, they know that something strange happened. They go through the wormhole, and this really bothers the wormhole aliens. They send Dax back to the station, and they're holding Sisko there, and they won't let the wormhole open. So the Cardassians are stuck 70,000 light years away. Sisko is still trying to explain things to them. He's using baseball as an example, where you never know what pitch is going to be thrown, and pitch by pitch, the game takes shape. You don't know what it's going to look like until it's ended.
And they're kind of like, oh, so you revel in your ignorance? And he's mm-hmm. like, no, it's all about sort of how things come together. And I thought it was a pretty fascination of linearity to people who experience all time simultaneously.
And then we have Ghul Jasad shows up, and he's pissed. Ghul Dukat's ship is gone. He rolls up with 3 Cardassian ships. And they're demanding the station surrenders to them. He says, you have 1 hour to surrender. Then in the wormhole, Sisko keeps returning to the memories of watching his wife die. And these aliens don't understand why he chooses to exist there. And he's trying to explain he doesn't like it. It's hard for him to be here. And they're telling him, like, no, this is where you are. And he finally realizes that he's never let go of that. He's never allowed himself to move past that. And it was because, like he was saying, all of your experiences prepare you for consequences you face later. But the consequence of losing his wife was something that no experience had ever prepared him for. And he couldn't move past it. But now...
Right. It is as if he was literally trapped in the past, you know, in that sort of bigger Star Trek time travel way. Even though, yeah, it's sort of a metaphor for his mind being trapped there, his emotions being trapped there. Mm-hmm.
And Kira is bluffing to the Cardassians.
Kind of Kirk style.
Her station is falling apart. Nothing works. She tells Jasad, I will fight you. And he's letting her know this is a lost cause. She says, I don't care. All I do is fight lost causes. I'm a Bajoran. She tells O'Brien, you know, fire 6 torpedoes across their bows, a warning shot. And he says, that's all we have is 6 torpedoes. And so they do. She
I thought that was interesting because, like, that's a big ballsy Kirk style bluff.
Yeah.
And it only sort of works for a brief time because the Cardassians are pretty sharp. They kind of, they're like, let's keep poking.
And then the Cardassians are able to scan the station and they see that it has this full armament, but they don't believe it. They're like, oh, there's no way this is possible. So they call the bluff and they fire back. The station is losing shields. O'Brien is barely able to rework some systems, get a couple of phaser blasts off. And it's finally like shields are about to go out. Things on the promenade are exploding. Odo and Dr. Bashir are trying to rescue civilians that are injured from the explosions. And Kira finally says, okay, prepare to surrender. But then the wormhole opens. And she tells him, I told you so, there is this wormhole, and you didn't believe me. And then all of a sudden, Benjamin Lafayette Sisko flies through in the Rio Grande, haul in a Cardassian warship. Like, hey, did you Cardassian fuckheads lose something? Here's your damn ship.
Hell again, yeah. Verbatim.
Yeah, from the script.
And the wormhole aliens agree to grant safe passage to anyone who wants to go explore the Gamma Quadrant. The Cardassians leave because the Enterprise shows up. Sisko tells Picard, like, you know what? I want to stay. I was wrong. There's something here that I want to be a part of and contribute to. And he's for the first time, he's really moving past, the loss of his life and trying to move his life forward.
Mm-hmm. If I'm not mistaken, Picard probably had some notion that he had that in him because he's like, yeah, I actually hadn't even contacted anybody about getting you replaced. Mm-hmm. He was supposed to be doing that, and he's like, yeah, I didn't do that.
I think he was just slacking. go around the table, starting with Dave.
Do we want to change it up? Do we want to start with someone else?
I'll go.
Okay, well, starting with Trent, what do you think about this episode?
I thought it was, like, one of the better introductions to a Star Trek. Up until this point, we're not staying stationary in Star Trek. We're always following a
exploratory mission.
Yeah, exactly. They're going around. They're discovering new aliens. They're going on adventures. But for the first time, it feels like we're really in one place where we can sort of develop people other than those who are on the ship. Mm-hmm. And I feel like it does a really good job at that. We have the captain. He's got a chip on his shoulder. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that I told you, I think, the first time I was watching it, it feels like an old-timey Western, yeah, where the new sheriff is rolling into town. Mm-hmm. You've got a barkeep in Quark.
Yeah, yeah.
And he's up to no good. You've got even the constable, I think they call him, right, in Odo.
Some of the terms they use, because they definitely have their own vocabulary for the station to set it off. Like the promenade and the runabout, mm, and stuff like that kind of all sound like they could also be Old West terms.
Yeah.
If you think about it.
You know, so we're on the outskirts. And I think that one of the things going back, I think I told you, was we're no longer in the grand idea of Star Trek, this beautiful future. Now we're in the nitty gritty of what makes that beautiful future possible.
Right, now they're over in Palestine.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, the Bajorans are allegories for so many things you can draw from real life. But you can say that, you know, they were Native Americans out. It's the frontier to us, but to them it was, just their home.
That's their life.
Yeah.
Or their, like, the occupation from the Cardassians was terrible. You can compare that to, you know, Palestinians under Israeli rule. Or you can also compare it to Jewish people in the Holocaust with the way some, right, some of them were rounded up into,
yeah,
camps.
It's thankfully not one-to-one comparison where you're like, this is definitely the story they're trying to tell, but it's for sure touching on big bits and pieces, yeah, of all of that,
like,
stuff.
Like, any, like, majorly oppressed nation of people, mm-hmm, in history could probably be an allegory for, right, the, or could be an analog for the Bajorans.
And what's interesting is that they go beyond, like, the oppression has completed, but sort of, by the time we get to this, and it's about sort of like what happens afterwards, which is not something you normally, mm-hmm, see. Normally, they'll, you know, that's when, like, Picard or Kirk would be like, well, good luck with that. We'll send some supplies. Gotta go. On, mm-hmm, to the next episode.
Absolutely.
So Dave, what do you think of this episode?
So, yeah, so my memory of seeing this back in
92.
My memory of it at the time was of being kind of disappointed. I think that was when I had sort of decided that, maybe Trek wasn't for me, or, you know, the new Treks were just never going to quite hit the sweet spot the original did. And so I kind of went into it, I think, with that presumption, and I think I was not much into it. I ended up really liking Babylon 5, which I saw as, like, the anti-Trek, which had a very similar premise to DS9, you know, at, mm-hmm, least, you know, station-based and all that, and a bit more on the gritty side. And I think I at first found Sisko back in those days a little too, like Picard, almost Shakespearean. He was very dramatic, you know.
Yeah. Well, they're both stage guys. They're both old school theater.
Either of them
stage
I could see
guys
playing King Lear or Othello or whatever. But upon revisit, really, really liked it. I would agree that it's probably in the top like in the top two or three best Star Trek premieres overall.
Yeah, and I always remember this for some reason before today, and I've seen this so many times, but it might be because I've seen it too many times.
Mm-hmm.
But I remembered not liking this episode as much as some of the other premieres. And I had just rewatched Deep Space Nine. I finished rewatching it last year.
Mm-hmm.
I'm actually about to start rewatching it again with the girlfriend later this week.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm going to see Emissary again in a few days.
Yeah, yeah.
And I was kind of like dreading that when I started it today. But I'm just so invested in these characters. This is my favorite Star Trek show growing up. You know, this is the one that I watched every
you said
Saturday
growing up,
night.
Has that changed?
No, but,
okay. but that's where it made its mark on you.
Yes,
it's a continuing process. Right.
And were you around for when it debuted?
I didn't watch the first two seasons on the air. I got in around season three,
mm-hmm.
and even then I was pretty young. I was like nine,
right?
But I was already like.
But it felt like it was your Trek, probably.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and this and Voyager were on the air at the same time, but I always liked Deep Space Nine a little bit more, and I also, one of the reasons why I saw this episode so many times is in order to see the original pilot, I had to go to like Suncoast or some other store like that in the mm-hmm. 90s and buy the VHS
yeah.
tape mm-hmm. with like my birthday money or for like mowing mm-hmm. yards or something. I had the officially released VHS tape of The Emissary. And so I would watch that in the VCR a lot.
Kids today don't know.
Yeah,
they don't know.
That was a bunch of gibberish to anyone. Born after the towers fell.
They're like, yeah, why didn't you just torrent it? What are you even talking about?
Yeah, so I watched this a lot. Like, because I would just rewind it and watch it again.
Right, you had to work for that shit.
And,
you gotta get your money's worth.
Mm-hmm.
And the where I am now, after just recently rewatching the show and getting ready to rewatch it again, though, I've always been so invested in these characters, but especially just after coming off seeing the season 7 finale a few months ago,
mm-hmm.
I just really dug. I got like emotional watching this. Like I started like tear up a couple of times because mm-hmm. I'm so.
Right, you kind of know where these people will
yeah.
end up,
yeah.
and all that.
And
yeah.
Sisko is my favorite captain,
mm-hmm.
and that's kind of an unpopular opinion. I think
you know I say sort of yes because you know it's always Kirk Picard, but I have noticed. I would just say like in the last 10 years or so. Deep Space Nine has definitely been charting higher and yeah. higher as time goes by.
Which is like, weird, because...
Fandom is finally, like, sort of embracing
it. And I remember when everyone disliked it. I remember when I would, you know, talk to someone a little older than me, and they would be like, I like the original series or The Next Generation, but I never could get into Deep Space Nine. And it baffles me now that I hear, like, everyone loves it.
The DS9 fanboys were real. Yeah, we're out there.
Yeah, you're
know?
Like, where were you when I needed you?
Yeah.
you know, maybe it was because Galactica came along from Ron Moore, of course. And that, like, made it okay for sci-fi to really dig in fucking deep on the grittiness again.
Yeah.
And then they're like, oh, you know what else had done that a ways back? That Deep Space Nine.
Well, mm-hmm. I think what really made it catch on later... is because the show was so much more serialized than not just
really?
Any other Star Trek, but anything else being made on
yeah.
TV at that time.
Right.
Especially things that were originally broadcast and direct to syndication. Like, it didn't even have a network. Some people wouldn't know like what time it was coming on in their area,
mm-hmm.
if any of the stations in their area were playing it. Like, it seems like a terrible way to distribute a hyper-serialized story. But then later when DVD came out and then now like streaming on Netflix,
right.
when people can binge watch it, it feels like the most modern Star Trek show.
Right. Yeah, even Voyager I think was notably more, you know, kind of a very monster of the week, for
yeah.
lack of a better
yeah.
word. You
yeah,
know,
they...
very standard kind of classic, you know, discreet adventures.
Mm-hmm.
There was kind of a broad overarching thing. But kind of in the same way that I guess, like, in the old days, like, the Fugitive TV show, he'd always be on the run, but he'd have a different adventure each week that would resolve each
mm-hmm.
week.
So, did this episode do a good job of setting up the show and you know, whetting your appetite? It was a good, like,
yeah.
issue one where...
I really feel like watching more of it right
You should.
Now.
You need to watch the whole damn thing.
You know, I think I'm sort of maybe more aware of structure now than I was when I first watched it, and I, like, there's a lot set up here. It's a... interesting political situation, which is, you know, that's, again, not something that you can get away from in the next episode. It's going to be like, this is your life.
There's consequence.
You're going to have to hang around in this. Right from the outset, I'd forgotten that, yeah, Sisko kind of, although he has some of those idealistic elements of Trek captains, he's, you know, an honorable guy in so many ways. You know, and you see that, you know, like, really, he cares so much for his family. But right out of the gate, he's like, I'm going to blackmail this guy to make this station get up and running. you know, I liked, you know, immediately liked Kira, Odo, Dax. I think I didn't, yeah, I don't know why I kind of, I think I was just going in uncharitably before and kind of not allowing myself to see all the potential in there. You know, the overarching story that's set up, and aside from just all the interesting things that might happen, yeah, on that kind of Monster of the Week level, which I will always have a soft spot for because that was the format for Star Trek when I grew up, you know?
Mm-hmm. And I agree. I think that it sets up a grayer area of Star Trek that I'm really a fan of. We have Kirk and we have Picard. They're going around and they're whooping aliens with their bare fists. They're out there on the front lines doing the right things. And I think that what we set up here is a bit of a grayer Star Trek where the lines between Klingon and the Federation and Ferengi and the Federation, that's a bit blurrier.
Well, you know, one of the things I noticed is when Sisko talks to Picard, he is so pissed at him that I'm like, he's talking to him the way that normally only a villain of on the show would be talking to him.
Absolutely, absolutely.
And like, that's your main character.
Yeah, I agree.
Like, the last time he saw this guy's face, he was murdering his wife.
Yeah. And so we're in a bit where it's not so clear cut now, which I think Gene would have hated, but I think for storytelling purposes.
Yeah, there is a question to be had about Star Trek philosophy here.
And I love the Roddenberry philosophy. I think it's a great optimistic view that we should aspire to be the Federation. That should be our goal. As far as the characters in Deep Space Nine, it always worked with me and felt compatible with that because the human characters are still, that's still their objective, that's still their goal.
Mm-hmm.
Now some of the non-humans might be a little morally ambiguous.
This sounds racially tinged, what you just said. The human characters are noble, the non-human characters are morally gray.
Not all of them, some of them. There are some nasty humans in every Star Trek.
Sure, sure.
Yeah,
original
absolutely.
Series had like some captain or commodore like went off his rocker and is doing something bad, like, you know, that happens,
right?
But yeah, like, generally humans are good guys and some aliens are good guys, some aliens are bad guys,
right?
And some aliens are harder
to
find.
The Federation of course also includes Vulcans and all of that,
of course, yeah.
Was there anything this episode didn't do very well that you thought it should have done better?
You know, in retrospect, I think when I was first watching it, I think I got pretty early on that, you know, the kind of what they were doing with Sisko as far as, like, him being sort of unstuck in time or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I thought that they maybe slightly belabored the point. But, you know, overall, I really liked there's several things at work in here, you know, like meeting all the new crew members, cleaning up the station, you know, realizing that they're in a, like, this tenuous spot where they're not like really wanted necessarily by the Bajorans. There's station action where the Cardassians literally are attacking, so you do get to see the station in action. And you get to see like O'Brien kind of pulling Scotty type stuff. They're like really pushing like what they can accomplish with some busted up technology.
The guy who only just operated the transporter on TNG.
He really comes into his own. Like, even in this first episode, I'm like, oh, I'm really liking him.
Mm-hmm.
And then you get the big sci-fi idea, like a nice focused one of you know, of a person who, you know, for people who are aliens who are kind of unstuck in time, a person who is kind of more metaphorically unstuck in time over a tragedy. It's strong science fiction idea. So I think they get their big idea, they get some action sequences and character development. I actually think it's a pretty strong outing. You know, maybe I might have like cut 5 minutes or something overall just to tighten it up. But overall, I think it's a really strong outing.
I have to agree, yeah.
I never liked the theme music.
What? Well, they redo the theme music with a faster tempo in season 4.
Really?
And it sounds better.
I think they're both fine.
But to get to it, you need to watch seasons 1 through 3, and then you can watch season 4.
No, I want to jump to the cool thing.
You'll have to watch all of it, and so will you.
Yeah. If you're checking this out and you like the pilot, please watch the rest of Deep Space Nine. It just gets better and better every year.
Every season.
It consistently improves.
Mm-hmm.
You know who I was kind of not looking forward to as I was watching it? I was like, this is sort of memories of, you know, the Ferengi were set up to be these big bads originally in Star Trek Next Generation.
Yeah, and they turned into a joke.
Yeah.
Right, real quickly. And
they're almost like the Jar Jars of like, nobody liked them, and they just became this big joke.
They always had the kind of, like, the false teeth, and they sounded a little bit silly. But, like, right out of the gate, I kind of liked Quark. I was feeling this more than I normally was. He seemed a little more nuanced. Like, yeah, he was after the Prophet, but he wasn't just like, Prophets, rather, not the Prophet.
Right.
But he wasn't like, money. You know, it wasn't all just nothing but Latin.
No, he feels real. He feels like a natural character.
Absolutely.
And I'm guessing that was Michael Piller's idea, but just to give some explanation.
Michael Piller is the actor?
Well, no, he's the showrunner, the writer. The first couple of seasons of Deep Space Nine was ran by Gene Roddenberry and Rick Berman. They had Maurice Hurley.
So Roddenberry was still around at that point. Okay, I wasn't sure.
I didn't know that.
I meant Next Generation, I'm sorry. First couple seasons of Next Generation. And you had Maurice Hurley for 2 years, and then they got rid of him. He was like the head story editor, or basically like the showrunner.
Mm-hmm.
And then season 3, they brought in a guy, Michael Piller. Was a big baseball fan.
Uh-huh.
And you notice, like, halfway through season 3, Next Generation starts getting a lot better.
Right.
And after season 5 of Next Generation, he left to start Deep Space Nine. And I guess that's why Ben Sisko is a big baseball fan.
Mm-hmm. I thought that was a nice humanizing aspect there.
Yeah.
Honestly, a lot of the hobbies and interests of Trek people tended to be, especially in the Next Generation era, a little bit, I'm going to say, frou-frou. It was all opera and playing the violin and reciting Shakespeare.
Well, Captain, come see my poetry reading.
The most modern piece of entertainment that they enjoy was probably like Picard's San Francisco detective, Private Eye, from like the 1930s.
So yeah, liking sports seems like a kind of, that's a more rugged thing than was traditionally done.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we know Commander Riker liked Parisi's squares.
Oh.
But yeah, just it's a much stronger episode than what we saw in the Next Generation, and it's setting up a very interesting story that knew right off of the bat that, you know, we're going to stick in one place and things will have consequence. We're not going to be able to just reset the status quo. We're going to see an evolving story.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Or multiple stories and subplots. And
you know, on a pure drama level, too, since we had just talked about Encounter at Farpoint in the previous episode, where I thought Q did not grab me a whole lot in that first episode as their space mixes Piddalick. Nor had Grappler Zorn.
But Gul Dukat
is a great bad
guy. He's a good bad guy.
And even the other sort of more henchmen-y Cardassians are like, you're like, oh, these guys are smart.
Dukat hasn't even gotten bad yet.
Yeah.
He'll get bad. Like,
I'm looking forward to it.
He'll get Tony Montana bad. Just say goodnight to the bad guy.
But just closing thoughts. Any final things you want to get out about Emissary?
I think it works. You know, we introduce some characters. I think that it was one of the few first episodes where they knew what they wanted to do. They weren't working on a limited budget. They weren't trying to reintroduce characters. So they knew what they wanted to do and they did it, and they had the opportunity to do that for one of the first times, and I thought they did it pretty successfully, I guess.
Mm-hmm. I found that I was like emotionally engaged more than I have been with some of the other premieres. Even those, like, some of those flashback scenes where you see like Dax, the parasite thing, the symbiote, going from being transferred from her
Curzon
mm-hmm. to Jadzia, right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I was like, oh, you know, this is like kind of like a moving moment or whatever. You know, it's like has a lot of import to it. A lot of the stuff with Cisco's flashbacks. I wasn't wild about him going, ow! At that one part.
I fucking hate that shit.
Okay. This guy has been bitching about how...
Bitching? I've been complaining about
Avery
how it's
Brooks,
a...
Avery Brooks' line deliveries.
Woo!
He's Ric Flair. Woo! That's...
I don't know. It just feels real to me. It's like, I know people who make noises.
When I get
like
happy,
that.
I go, woo!
Who you know what I think is... You're right. Like, people do kind of do that kind of stuff. But it felt like the Shakespearean actor guy doing it, like, like, and I looked upon Juliet and, oh!
And I went,
you know, like, and one of those ones where you're like, that was kind of a little cheesy.
So I have this weird relationship with Captain Sisko, or Commander Sisko, okay. Where...
You have a weird relationship with...
Where, and I'll say this, because, like, I know that he'll never watch this or ever give a shit. But I wasn't particularly close to my dad growing up. We're really good friends now. But, you know, we have good love and respect for each other. But as a kid, we were very distant.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted Ben Sisko to be my dad like he was Jake's dad.
He was like your tough love dad. Yeah. Your tough love fictional dad.
I wanted to go play baseball with him in the holidays.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, if Ben Sisko was your dad, that'd strike me as surprising. But we could talk about that on another episode.
He was
episode.
My TV dad.
Right? Like, if he were to, say, put a hand on your shoulder and kind of give you a pat, you'd be like... Ow!
Absolutely. Like, I love that
no,
moment.
I get that. He's got that quality too.
I love that moment with him and Jake in this episode where Jake is sad that he's gonna have to eat rations because the replicators don't work.
Mm-hmm.
And Sisko says, "Hey, we're gonna have to rough it a little bit."
Yeah. Then, there's a sense of like sort of history and like, hey, you know, this, we've done this before, or there's a warmth between them.
Yeah, and then like when he's like mocking Jake, when Jake's like, okay, and then he exaggerates, he's like, okay, like,
yeah.
You know, the whiny.
Yeah.
Like, I
did feel more of an emotional connection to these characters.
Than Wesley
yeah. Crusher.
Yeah. Than almost all of the next gen characters in their initial appearances. Bashir is maybe a little bit distant. He feels the most like a kind of a next-gen character, just kind of like, I'd just like to get out here and explore and see the sights.
Mm-hmm.
Well, he probably got the least screen time.
Right. But mm-hmm. I still found him engaging and likable.
Yeah. Wait till you see what they
I'm
do
down,
with him, though. They
I'm
they,
down with
they
that.
Have some cool Bashir stories that they get into.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And there's also a lot of other characters that I don't think you're familiar with. You remember Garrick, the tailor?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
I know you've seen some stuff with him.
For Out of Order, yeah.
Yeah, there's some other characters that they throw in there, and it's a real healthy mix, and you have a bunch of characters, a bunch of stories and storylines and subplots, and you should definitely move forward with your Deep Space Nine.
I have a question for you about Deep Space Nine and that overarching story, which maybe you can't tell me too much without like revealing all, but so there is this spiritual subtext going on of like finding the prophets and what's going on with them. You're a godless heathen like me. How do you
okay,
feel about that?
Sure, I got this.
He's
because
got it.
It's because they're aliens, isn't it?
You know,
aliens.
Star Trek has a history with the Vulcans sometimes having like mysticism.
Sure.
Like the Katra, is it sparked soul that was like mind melded into bones and transferred.
Right.
And
they talk about it in spiritual terms. They don't say like,
but,
you know, he has like 2.7 of the Katra downloaded or whatever. But, they still get spiritual about it.
There's a scientific or there's a science fiction rather explanation for all of it.
Right.
You know, the Vulcans mind meld. They're telepathic. They can transfer a consciousness from one
right.
body to
there's
another.
There's actually something going on that is not magic.
Yeah, Q is basically a god, but no, there's no alien race that we know of that has like a religion built around them. The wormhole aliens are aliens.
Right, but when those priests see when that priest first sees Sisko, he's like, "The time has come. You know what must be done." And you know it's all very mystical, chosen one-y. And I know that does play into kind of his story later on, but chosen one stuff is very mystical.
It is, but it's there's. I mean,
scientific
shows
underpinnings.
It shows how Sisko got set up on this destiny.
Yeah.
In the end, but I think that in season 7.
Like they put like a Jesus tracker on him and he didn't notice. And he's like,
the Jesus tracker.
They're like, this will go off later. And you'll come to God.
But yeah, like, Bajorans sometimes receive visions from the prophets.
Mm-hmm.
And it's aliens telepathically communicating.
Okay.
Yeah, that becomes a bigger, the faith versus science conflict becomes a thing that they explore later on.
But yeah, that's down the road in Deep Space Nine.
Just wanted to see how that set.
Yeah, that's another episode, I think.
Yeah. But yeah, I think we all three really seem to like this episode, and hopefully Star Trek Discovery will start off this well.
Yeah.
Yep. If it does at least this well, then I think it'll be on track.
So if you also liked it, let us know what you liked in the comments. If you didn't like it, tell us why we're wrong.
I want to hear about people who are lukewarm on it.
Yeah. If you're lukewarm, if you're not underwhelmed or overwhelmed, if you're somewhere in the middle. And also check out the discussions we did on the original series pilots, plural, Where No Man Has Gone Before, and
The Cage.
That is part of our Star Trek number one series. And then we also did an episode on Encounter at Farpoint. And soon, before Star Trek Discovery comes out, we'll be sure to cover Caretaker for Voyager and Broken Bow for Enterprise.
Which, and once you've heard all of that, if you've not been watching all of these Star Treks, you can determine what's the one for you. I mean, the answer is all of them, but you can decide what's the best one for you.
All of them.
So that's going to wrap it up, and until next time,
live long
and prosper, y'all. Thank all of you so much for checking out this installment of Text Trek. I hope you enjoyed it. Please be sure to like our YouTube videos and subscribe to our channel. Audio-only versions of episodes are available at our website, www.text-trek.com. Please check out our site, especially if you just want an audio-only podcast. We have that available for you. Y'all can also keep up with us online. You can follow us on Twitter, @TXTrek, or you can check us out on Facebook at www.facebook.com/text-trek. Please, by all means, let us know what you think by dropping a comment anywhere you see fit. We definitely want to hear your feedback. Let us know what you liked and what you would like to see more of, what you would like to see differently going forward. If you want to email me directly, go ahead. I can be reached at fatheryactual@text-trek.com. Thank all y'all again. Take care.